And welcome back to another Liberty Librarian. This is your host, Heather Biederman. I hope you're having a lovely Monday. Tomorrow I go back to work as a librarian full time. So I am just like a lot of the kids right now going, oh, summer's almost over. How'd it go so fast? Yes, it did go fast. But there's always stuff going on. And today I'm going to talk, as always, about our intellectual freedom news. And I have something that's kind of close to my heart. This weekend I went and saw Acrocats. Acrocats is a cat show, which sounds sexy, but it's actually just felines. And they are rescue cats who are trained to do acrobatics and fun stuff. But I'm going to talk a little bit about that a little later today. So if you've seen it before, post about it on Facebook, on Liberty Librarian, my site there, and send me a message if you want to know more. I'll post some links for you too. But it was really cool. I'm just going to say that. So I'm really excited to talk to you guys about that today. So we have a little bit of news to go over today, and then we'll get to the commentary. But first, we're going to pay a little bit of bills, and then we're going to get into the intellectual freedom news.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
Come join us as we peel away the layers of the unseen, unknown, and uncharted. And we hope you tune in late night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, to get ready to find a clarity after dark.
So, as always, I get a lot of my news from the internet, but I also get a lot of it from the Intellectual Freedom blog, which has Intellectual Freedom News. And every week they have a new listing of lots of great stuff. And that's put out by the Office for Intellectual Freedom of the American Library Association. So go ahead over there if you need more, or you find out you're liking what I say and you want to read the complete articles. They're all there. I'll post a link to it this week so you can go take a look. Very great stuff. And, you know, it's kind of important to be looking out for all sorts of things that are going on in the world where they're taking away our freedoms and our rights. So if you see things that you think we should be worried about, please send them to me on the Liberty Librarian Facebook page. It's important to me. And I'm having a cat that's staring right at me in my face, and he's being extra naughty today. So if you hear some scuttling, that's probably him. So first in news today, let's get to the news, right? The meat. So on Vox News, Vox.com, they have an article called How Facial Recognition Became the Most Feared Technology in the U.S. by Sheeran Gafferty on August 9th. So they talk about two lawmakers are drafting a new bipartisan bill that could seriously limit the use of technology across the U.S. So let's talk about that a little bit. So facial recognition, something that I'm a little bit terrified by. I see how it can make our lives easier. A lot of people are excited about being able to just hold up their phone and it knows it's you and you can just get right in. But let me tell you, there's dangers to that. Someone can knock you out, hold your phone up to your face and get into your information without your consent. Things can be used. They can fake it. You know, they can fake fingerprints. They can fake face. They can do anything, you know, if somebody wants to get in your stuff. Passwords are still more complicated. And you can still get those hacked too. But don't make it so easy for someone to steal your identity, please. So anyway, it's on the minds of everyone in our country. So across the U.S., local politicians and national lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have started introducing rules that bar law enforcement agencies from using facial recognition technology to surveil everyday citizens. You know, it's a whole Big Brother thing that I've always been worried about and always warned that they're putting cameras in, and they do it to, you know, they say to check on people, and they can't be everywhere. And I'm okay with them not being everywhere, right? So in the past couple months, there have been three cities, San Francisco, Oakland, and Somerville, Massachusetts, have passed laws to ban government use of the controversial technology. And this analyzes pictures of live video of human faces in order to identify them. So real futuristic cop stuff, right? So Cambridge, Massachusetts is also moving towards a government ban. Congress recently held two oversight hearings on the topic, and there are at least four pieces of current federal legislation to limit technology in some way. Now, police are, they're really pushing for it because it'll make their jobs easier. However, it will, as a citizen, you should be worried about it because you're going to lose privacy at any moment. They can use it to track you. And what's to say, you know, something, you know, speeding or breaking laws is one thing, but what if they're using it to see what political meetings you're going to? What if they use it to, let's say you go to a gay bar and they don't like that and they use it to track you down. I mean, what's to limit them using their own forced morality on you? So I agree with the direction this is going. And it says that Recode, the section of this Vox website, has learned that two top lawmakers, Representative Elijah Cummings, a Democrat from Maryland, and Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, so bipartisan, plan this fall to introduce a new bipartisan bill on facial recognition. According to the representatives from both legislatures' office, they say that. So the specifics of the bill are still being hashed out, but they're thinking it could include a pause on the federal government's acquisition of new facial recognition technology. So that would be a good thing if they would not be using that, because we are right on the precipice of a huge Big Brother technology thing. So facial recognition is a rare case where regulators are working together. I think people are afraid. They can see the potential of how this can be used in a bad way. And the legislatures are actually trying to get ahead of the technology instead of catching up to it. That's because it's so powerful and it's moving so fast and has a potential to infringe on American civil liberties all across the board. And it doesn't matter what your political persuasion, it could have a chilling effect on free speech. So we need to make sure that there is something in place. If you're going to make a law, make it so it protects our freedom. That I agree with completely. So it seems there's a huge moment right now in regulating this. They're working on surveillance issues broadly for years, and now something about this is striking up a nerve with people. There's an advocacy group called Fight for the Future, which I want to read more about, that's been pushing for a national ban on facial recognition technology. Evan Greer, the director of that group, says she believes in the next few months, many more cities or states will regulate the technology. Four states have already introduced facial recognition legislation. So it's something that everyone's thinking about right now. And however, even though that there is all this legislation that's coming up, private companies are still using the technology. Even in cities like San Francisco with facial recognition bans, companies like Apple are still free to sell their cell phones that have facial recognition built into the products. So there's a ban, but you can still have it. So that's a different and less controversial application of the technology. I still think you should be worried, mainly because consumers have the choice not to use it. But I think a lot of people are unaware of the damage and the dangers. So it's something I worry about. And if companies don't properly notify users when it employs this tech, like a federal court recently found that Facebook is guilty of, they could face legal and financial penalties, these companies. So, but when facial recognition is used by law enforcement agencies, the general public is often unknowingly having their faces monitored, scanned, and tracked. That's why lawmakers are increasingly setting a higher bar for government agencies using the tools. Good. So some police departments and advocates of the technology have argued that outright bans are going too far, that the technology can help law enforcement more effectively stop crime. Yeah, because it's Big Brother and they're always watching you. That, of course, that it would be more convenient for them. They could always have like AI kind of paying attention to you, right? So already dozens of local police departments across the U.S. use the technology to match driver's license pictures and mugshots to criminal databases. But the recent uptick in regulation has the potential to slow down that process. And they mentioned this in the article. It's an Orwellian use case, and I agree with that completely. One of the main reasons why facial recognition technology is being legislated is because it's so scary. Unlike your cell phone or computer, there's no way to turn off your face. Your face is everywhere. You know, you can't. I've read things about people wearing special glasses that mess up facial technology, but it keeps getting better and better to the point where in a few years, those kind of measures may not even work. So in China, the technology is already ubiquitous and used for mass surveillance of ordinary citizens in public life. Most alarmingly, to target the Muslim ethnic minority that's already called an automated racism. So they're targeting a group to see what they're up to. So for many Americans, a society where government is always watching you is inherently un-American. Hear, hear. That is the best thing that they have to say here. I agree completely. And it says, I think, quote, I think people are understanding that this technology is different, said Nima Singh Gulani, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. She continues, the idea that the government may be able to identify or track people when they're at a protest or visiting a doctor is especially concerning. Yeah, where you go in your free time shouldn't be the government's business. People are also concerned about the way facial recognition has been rolled out. In many jurisdictions, it's been done in secret and without much community input. So if they don't tell you about it and they're using it, there's something very sneaky about that. You should fear that. And it says that the powerful software can be used by law enforcement agencies to track anyone they deem suspicious without any reasonable evidence that they've even committed a crime. That should make all of your alarms go off in your head, right? So a few years ago, it says police in Orlando, Florida started piloting Amazon's facial recognition software. It's called Recognition with a K in there, that connects data from live video feeds with facial recognition technology to watch and track people in real time. So this pilot program, which placed 4 surveillance cameras in public areas around the city in Orlando, which the police department said was only used to test on its own officers, was rolled out without any public notice or legal guidelines. After the sustained public scrutiny and reports of technical limitations, the department decided in June to drop its contract with Amazon. This is in Orlando. This case was an example how in a lawless environment, facial recognition technology can escalate into a PR nightmare. So if you are going to do it, you need to have all the people in that community, be it in a town, in a business, have them all aware of it, because people need to have a right to know that they're being filmed. And the technology is following them, that you're living in a community of fear. So 3 years ago, the ACLU started working with cities to pass legislation and let those cities take control over the rollout of surveillance technology, including facial recognition, as well as other tools such as license plate scanners. And it's what's called the Community Control Over Police Surveillance Ordinance. So now 13 cities in the U.S. have passed such laws, and several other cities and states are working on passing similar legislation. But all this regulation doesn't stop federal law enforcement from using facial recognition. The Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law Center discovered last month that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had access to databases of driver's license photos from 21 states. That means if you live in one of those states, your driver's license photo could be used without your knowledge in a digital version of a criminal lineup. Great. The fact that ICE is using facial recognition to help deport immigrants is a major reason liberal politicians, especially those in the sanctuary cities, want to rein in government use of this technology. So, although the first cities to ban this have been liberal strongholds like San Francisco and Oakland, lots of Republican lawmakers are also having concerns. So Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, co-chairs the House Oversight Committee, which held recent hearings on the technology. It's been a he's a conservative leader on the topic, but it's bipartisan, so they're working together, which makes me very happy because that means things might be done on it. Facial recognition is concerning from the perspective of government having too much power, said the spokesperson from Jordan's office at the House Oversight Committee. And that's where that congressman's coming from. It's an instinctive civil libertarian and constructionalist perspective. So we need to protect our right to not be filmed constantly and have it used to monitor what we're doing. And another reason why they're putting a pause on facial recognition has been they feel like it's biased and it's less accurate when applied to people like women and people of color. So ACLU ran a test of Amazon's facial recognition software and found that it incorrectly identified 28 Black members of Congress as criminals. How great is that? it's a racist program. So it's not obviously smart enough for that they can rely on it, and it's infringing on our rights, so we should maybe just not use it. And I'm going to talk in just a minute a little bit about MIT also said that software returned results for women and darker-skinned individuals that were biased. It says that it had difficulty recognizing women's faces and especially Black women's faces, and it can make life-altering decisions. It can alert the police to say that you've committed a crime and they should go get you, even though you've never done anything and you're not the person that they're looking for. It's just not smart enough. So in a nutshell, it's pretty terrible. And it says that the police agencies are using the technology, facial recognition technology, in Black communities more heavily to target activists. So, with like Black Lives Matter, that they're, if there's anything that people are outspoken against the police, they're using it to target them. So that's a misuse of the technology right there. And both ACLU and MIT cases, Amazon said they disputed the inaccurate findings, said they didn't apply the correct settings. They said that the technology should have a 99% threshold for accuracy. But in the real world, if they're having this much problem with it, why do you think this wouldn't happen? It's kind of nerve-wracking to me to think that, in testing where they're having science people from MIT test it and they're having things go terribly wrong, do you think it's going to be a lot better in a police department? I don't think so. Okay, so in places like Maryland, police agencies have used the facial recognition technology more heavily in Black communities, right? An example of this use was in Baltimore. They used it to identify and arrest people who protested Freddie Gray's death at the hands of law enforcement. So that is just terrible. There are certainly a long history of certain groups and people being surveilled by government agencies. We can't allow that to go unchecked. That's the bigger issue. And Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern told Recode, the Cambridge City Council recently moved legislation forward for a facial recognition ban, and it will vote on it in the coming months. So there's a balance of having civil liberties and the right to privacy. People want to be safe, and so they use fear to push this forward. But the technology, it doesn't have, it's like we're in the Wild West with it. And, you know, everyone's excited to use it, but the potential to misuse it is very strong. So if it is going to go forward in any way, there needs to be a lot of checks on it, honestly. San Francisco was the first city to ban city government use of facial recognition in what's now considered by civil liberty advocates to be the gold standard for regulating the technology. And when it passed the ban, San Francisco also passed a broader surveillance oversight ordinance that requires city agencies to get city approval before purchasing other kinds of surveillance technologies, such as automatic license plate readers and camera-enabled drones. They're excited. Other cities are picking up on this, and I'm glad. You may want to mention to your local law people, your city councils, your city and state government, that it's important to maintain privacy. So hopefully you listen to this, and if you know anyone or it's important to you, go to your own local people and say, other cities are banning it. I really hope that you're considering it. Matt Cagle, a technology and civil liberties attorney at ACLU, who worked as a coalition on the coalition supporting the legislation in San Francisco, said that the case of facial recognition, the city made the right move in placing an all-out ban. The ACLU recently called for a nationwide temporary ban on face recognition for law enforcement and immigration enforcement purposes, co-signed by over 60 civil liberties, privacy, investor, and faith groups, until Congress fully debates what, if any, use should be permitted. And I think that's a good way to go. They need to figure this out. So, there's something that should be said when you have bipartisan agreement, that there's something terribly wrong, and even on most things we disagree, all the parties disagree. But I think on this, privacy should be important. No matter what political affiliation you hold, we need to protect that. And seeing how they've misused it for, immigration and deporting people, using it to arrest people, a lot of times people of color, and targeting people who may be anti-police. It shows that there's a lot of misuse going on. And the fact that it's not really perfect anyway, in that it's mistakenly saying that people who aren't criminals are criminals, you can't trust it. So I hope that around the country that it is banned or at least seriously thought out, that when they do use it, it is something that everyone in the community can agree on. So we'll see. I know I brought this up. It was one of the things I put it in the wrong spot on my thing. Let's see. Oops, I gotta undo that. There was MIT had, oh yeah, here it is. MIT had a little article. I just want to tie it right in because it fits perfect with it. The Google algorithm, the AI systems detecting hate speech. This is a kind of weird thing. So researchers built two AI systems and tested them on a pair of data sets. Oh, man, this is just so weird. Oh, this one isn't the one I was going to show you. No, that's fine. Before I go into this one, the MIT one, we covered it a little bit, but it did talk more about the bias. I closed it, so I'm like, I can't figure out what I did with it. So, human error. But I do think if you want to read more about how they came about and they tested it, when I had it up on the screen, it was basically a study. So everything is meticulously written down. So if Amazon or where whatever big tech is saying that their methods were flawed, I kind of doubt it, because it was meticulously written down every step of the way. So yes, facial recognition, that's big on my mind right now. Okay, back to Google. So their algorithm, got it, yes, I knew it. Like, I hate it when you get a word and you like, you know, I know I'm saying it wrong. So this is for detecting hate speech. You know, they want to have AI set up so that way they don't have to hire people to dig through the internet and look for hate speech, hate groups, potential terror accounts, because it's just too much for humans to look through. The internet is too big, right? But they made this AI to detect hate speech. But the problem is it's racially biased. It's not going to work great. It was meant to spot abusive online content, far more likely to label tweets offensive if they're posted by people. They said that if someone was African-American, it was more likely to say that the tweets were offensive. And it is not even a human looking at it. So researchers built two AI systems and tested them on a pair of data sets of more than 100,000 tweets that have been annotated by humans with labels like offensive, none, and hate speech. One of the algorithms incorrectly flagged 46% of inoffensive tweets by African-American authors as offensive. Racist damn AI. So the tests in a bigger data set, including one composed of 5.4 million tweets, found that posts by African-American authors were 1.5 times more likely to be labeled as offensive. Why is it so racist? I don't know. So then the researchers then tested Google's Perspective, a new AI tool that the company lets anyone use to moderate online discussions, and they found similar racial biases. Is it because the people are making them or putting the bias in the program? I'm wondering. But it says there's a hard balance to strike. There's mass shootings perpetrated by white supremacists in the U.S. and New Zealand, and have led to growing calls from politicians for social media platforms to do more to weed out hate speech, which I hate to say it, but I'm not really in agreement with that. But I understand as a business that people want that, and especially private organizations, they have a right to do whatever they need to do, but you also have a right to leave. These studies underline just how complicated a task that is. So you do that, and it's targeting Black people. I think people that you're trying to protect are going to be a little mad. So, for example, if a Black person uses the N-word, it's very different than a white person using it. So if they use the N-word, it is not hate speech. But AI systems aren't smart. They don't know like the nuances that humans have and when it's appropriate, when it's not, when we're talking about something, when it's angry, when it's educational. So by rushing to use software to automatically weed out offensive language, we risk silencing minority voices. Moderating online content is traumatizing, difficult job. People have seriously, they've had mental breakdowns, hurt themselves because it's really hard to look at some of these horrible things over and over all day. Can you imagine? It's like, this came to my brain. It's when, like, the study where they have the houseplants and they yelled horrible things at them. And then the other houseplants, they told them they're beautiful. And the houseplants that they said they're ugly and stupid, they died. And the plants that they said, I love you, you're great, they thrived. So humans are kind of the same way. You show them the worst side of the horrors, the hate, and it kills us. So I think it would be the worst job I can imagine. But they want AI to do it, so that way human beings like don't have to go through it, and also it's lots cheaper. So there's the study that they did. shows that there are huge risks inherent in that approach. So we're trying to rely on technology to do these jobs for us, to protect us, to keep us from hearing and seeing things that we don't want to see. But it's not there yet. And it's not smart enough to know that, you know what, maybe some of these things are things that we need to hear or I want to hear. And why put this on a computer to just shut you down so you can't even find the things you're looking for? So I digress. Google. So I think they got a long ways to go. So let's see. I'm going to take a quick break. I'll be right back.
Solutions to Delusions. How do you do this? Well, join me every Friday night on the Delusion Solution Radio Show from 6 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time and 9 to 12 midnight Eastern Time right here on the Freedomizer Network, where we will be discussing and discerning the times by making sense of current events and bringing to light much-needed topics. Our call-in number is 347-324-3704 to listen in. Watching with your ears and listen with your eyes. I'm your host, Tara Dawn, and I'll see you there.
That was really pretty. I like that end part. It sounds lovely. Okay, so I needed to get a little drink because my throat was kind of, I'm like, oh, I'm scritchy. Okay, so we covered the AI. So now, one of the big things in the news is in the Pewtrust.org. It's a great website. They have an article called States Battle Big Tech Over Data Privacy Laws. So let me just make sure this is going good. There we go. Okay. So what's going on with this is there's states like California State Senator Robert Hertzberg, Democrat, has a debate on state data privacy. So data privacy is starting to come up in lots of states. And there's discomfort over the collection and sale of personal data, everyone. And it led a flurry of consumer data privacy bills this year in 2019, as state legislatures vied to follow California's lead in giving users more control over their personal information. Yay. But the legislative year ended with more of a whimper than a bang, as well-funded tech giants and other business concerns rushed to oppose the bills. And even California is scrambling to fix the details of its data privacy laws before it takes effect in January. So big money has put their defenses up, and they're trying everything in their power to take down some of these because they know this is their big money. Their big money is coming in from data. And of all the 24 states that considered data privacy legislation this year, only three enacted new laws, which are Illinois, Maine, and Nevada. So obviously they're getting out there and they're shutting it down. And they is the big tech. So there'll be more pressure for the legislatures next year. Since sessions ended in most states, a $5 billion fine against Facebook and a $700 million settlement with Equifax over data breaches have brought even more public attention to the issue. So people are worried about it, as they should be. And there's been continued revelations about election manipulations by Cambridge Analytica, which used personal data to profile voters. Great. So despite enthusiasm for more privacy rules by legislators and their constituents, many states have found themselves bogged down in this year when both details of high-tech operations and industry complaints. So So they're doing everything to stop any laws against them because they want to make money. I get it. But people want privacy too. So Pam Greenberg, a senior fellow for the National Conference of State Legislators who collected information on state consumer data privacy legislation, said that, the issue is complex. And the legislators are concerned about the impact of privacy legislation on both consumers and businesses. So I'm looking at an infographic for this, and it has states retreat on consumer data privacy. So they're all going in. 24 of them had laws on the books that they're trying to get through. And my own state, Minnesota, they show it's considered legislation. And states like California, they showed they enacted the law last year. And then there's ones like Nevada and Illinois that, and Maine that enacted a law in 2019. So a few of them have just created a task force, but almost more than half the states I'm looking at, you know, the middle of America seems like it doesn't seem to care as much about data privacy. It looks weird, but my own state does, and they considered the legislation, but they are not pushing forward, which is strange because you'd think the more liberal states would be doing that too, but privacy, y'all. But I feel like we need to get the word out about data privacy because the big money is just making it so people don't care and that they just trust in them to steal all your information and know everything about you. It's a dangerous world. So it's very complex. The Internet Association represents tech giants such as Google, Amazon, and Facebook has lobbied for a national approach, arguing that one federal standard like Europe's 2018 General Data Protection Regulation would be fairer and stronger. States should allow for a national privacy law to take shape that applies to the entire country, said Robert Callahan, the association's vice president of state government affairs. I'm going to pause here for a second and just say, if our giant tech people say this is a great idea, is it? Is it really? Is it, or is it just under their, it looks like they're doing something, but they aren't. That's what it seems more like to me. So the states, they say, should allow for national privacy law to take shape that applies to the entire country. So if a person is video chatting with their grandmother in Florida while they're in New York, they should both benefit from the same privacy protections. So they don't want it to be a state kind of thing, state by state. They want it to be nationwide, and they want it to be broad so that way they can get away with as much as they can. And on one hand, at least if we had something nationwide, these states that don't have anything going on, they would be covered with some protections, but I don't think it'll go as far as it needs to. Just my thinking. So many states are waiting for last-minute wrangling over the details in the California law before setting their own policies. They're looking to California to see how far they should go. And it was a former CIA analyst was working with the president of the Californians for Consumer Privacy, and that person's name is Mary Stone Ross, and they helped draft that state's legislation as a ballot initiative. The group agreed last year to drop its push for a ballot question in return for a similar state law passed by the legislature. So California passed this bill under time pressure in June 2018, giving consumers the right to see any of their data collected by a company or website and the ability to opt out of having it sold to third parties. Sounds cool. Then Governor Jerry Brown, Democrat, signed it into law, but many amendments fine-tuning the law are still pending with a deadline of September for the legislature to pass them. So it really hasn't gone totally into effect. So last minute changes threaten death by 1,000 paper cuts, as the California law will clearly establish a consumer's right to know what the personal data has been collected and a further right to opt out of any sale of that data. There are new rights and it's clearly a big win, said Stone Ross. You'll have a big red button on the web page to opt out. A lot of companies should choose to comply, will choose to comply. So bills are still pending that would amend California's law, including measures that would exclude some of the advertisements from definition of selling data and exclude people like job applicants from the definition of a consumer. But, you know, like if you apply for a job, that seems like there's some private data there too. So I would kind of hope that would stay. So, and they said in Illinois, a law signed last week bans insurers from using genetic testing information. Yeah, this is a scary one, to set health or accident insurance rates. So yeah, like using your medical data. Think about that. Why should they even look at that? Maine's new laws ban internet providers from selling personal information without consent. Etta's law requires websites and other businesses to provide a way for consumers to opt out of sales of personal information. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a national opt-out of selling your data? Just fill out one thing. If they're going to do this as a nationwide thing, you sort of like where you can have, like, you know, commercial people calling you on your phone. You opt out of that and they can't. And if they keep calling you, you can sue them basically. But you turn them in and then you get money for it. But I don't see them doing that. They just have so much lobbying power against normal people that it's going to be really tough. And it's more important than ever right now. You know, you have Equifax, however they say that, Facebook fines, implications for voter manipulation by using profiles with personal data in 2020. So it's coming up. This is going to be an abuse everywhere, and they need to get on this, because it's getting out of control. And there's the privacy rights advocates were caught off guard by the intense state-by-state battle. Big tech players have a lot of funding, and they can be everywhere at once, popping up in all the states. And people in the government that are against it are stretched really thin, and that's what they're counting on. So New York State's pending legislation would go even further than California's, establishing a consumer's right to sue over privacy or security breaches. And companies can, they need to act in the customer's best interest, even if it means forgoing profits from selling personal information. Well, you know, part of me is like, fat chance. We'll see. They have to put consumer privacy above companies' profit making. I tell you, I don't know many companies that would do that. Not unless they had to. So good luck to them on that. And they talked about the insurance companies, again, using genetic information to raise rates, and some employment agencies using financial data to offer lower pay because they already know you're poor. And even though this job should pay this, you'll take a lower rate because we know how poor you are. Yeah, they could do that. How much would that suck for you? Yes, it would suck a lot. So Thomas's bill didn't make it out of committee this year, but he said he plans on public hearings before the 2020 legislative session to gather more information from his constituents. Companies don't need all this information that can be used against you, and there's no oversight to this. States have to stand up because there's no regulation, and it's not going to come from the federal government, as divided as this country is right now. So the Internet Association, again, that big group of tech giants, opposed the New York bill. They said the law is unworkable for businesses that want to comply, citing the law's mandate to get consumer consent before selling data. Because they just want to sell your data. They do, I know. They make so much money from it, and they can control you, but it's not good. So this goes on and on to talk about each of the states, Vermont and Connecticut, and there's opposition from tech in each of these. Hawaii is another case, and I'm going through this in Connecticut, Hawaii, Louisiana, North Dakota, and Texas. There's task forces or advisory committees set up after privacy legislation was defeated. So they're still working on it. And privacy legislation was delayed for consideration until next year in states including Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington. And similar bills failed outright in Arizona, Florida, Kentucky, Maryland, Mississippi, Montana, and New Mexico. So it's out there, but there is so much opposition, it's going to be very difficult. And it's going to really, if they win, we lose. If the big tech has their way with our data and there's no oversight at all, we're all in big trouble. And that whole thing with the insurance should just be one of the things that pops up in your mind. But how much you make, how they target you for voting, they're going to know everything about you. So we all need to be worried about this. Okay. God, I got a lot of fear things this week, don't I? In the New York Times this week, it says New York Police Department has a DNA database that has people worried. And this is by New York Times, and Aaron Randall wrote this on the 16th. So what's terrifying about this DNA collection is they have, they're ramping up the collection and storage of people's DNA, sometimes without their knowledge or consent. So the police department, this goes back to me thinking about the facial recognition. It's new technology that they're using to do their jobs. But also DNA collection is a new part of how they're doing their job. So in New York, there are 82,473 genetic profiles in the city's database, known as the Local DNA Index System. This is an increase of nearly 29% in the last 2 years. So they're really growing it and putting a lot more importance into it. And this data comes from the Legal Aid Society. And the police say this database is effective in identifying criminals and solving crimes, but some New Yorkers are concerned that it violates privacy rights. And genetic database is one of those of many in the country that operate with very little, if any, oversight. So the big concerns that are obvious is privacy and trust. So more than 31,000 of the profiles were derived from children and adults who were suspected but not convicted of crimes. So it's essentially saying, give us your entire genome, says this person. Who is it? Aaron E. Murphy, a New York University law professor who's written about DNA databases and DNA profiling. So it says, give us your entire genome, even though we don't have any reason to believe you've committed a crime. So you're innocent, but we're going to hold on to it just in case you think of committing a crime later. They have no right to that. It's almost like you need a warrant to get that kind of thing, and they shouldn't have it. So Eric Bellamy told colleagues of the author that he was shocked that the police came to his home in 2016 unannounced and without a warrant and asked for his DNA in order to clear him of a crime. Maurice Silla said detectives who were seeking his DNA asked his niece intimidating questions about the family's immigration status. They had no reason to invade my privacy, he said. So the Legal Aid Society said these tactics could erode goodwill between neighborhoods and the community's police officers. But the police are obviously pushing back, right? So the police are countering the criticisms by highlighting closed cases. We're not indiscriminately collecting DNA, says Dermot F. Shee, the department's chief of detectives. And the Brooklyn's district attorney office said that DNA has helped solve 270 cases, including sexual assaults and homicides. So on that side, I can see, yeah, that could be helpful. But the role of the database became a flashpoint in the trial of Chanel Lewis, the Brooklyn man convicted in April of murdering Karina Vetrano, a jogger in Queens. So another man, Avery Bovell, was convicted in 2014 of raping a woman after his DNA was recovered from an object he touched during a separate robbery. So they're saying without having that resource, we would never have been able to identify one of the attackers in the case. Yep. True. But is it the right thing to do? So what they're thinking about, they kind of like leave it from here. You need to be be aware that the reasons they have for getting this can help, but privacy. And I do think I worry about them taking it from children or people who aren't even criminals. What good is that? And when you think about all the people who have done like those genetic tests to find out their, you know, their genealogy history, and you find out later that police and federal, you know, like federal FBI and CIA are tapping into that to solve their own cases, it seems like it's a big misuse of this information. And who's to say down the road that not just police, but, you know, anyone that can have access, like insurance companies, could be looking at your DNA and going, we see a potential for this disease, so we're not going to insure you, or we're going to put you at a higher rate. So there's privacy issues, especially if you didn't consent to it. And I think that if you're in the, I don't know, if you're in the federal system where you've already committed a crime, sure, they're probably going to take your DNA. And I can see that. You lose consent when you're a prisoner. Does that make it right? Probably not. But they're going to do it anyway. But for normal people, I don't see how this is a good thing. So we'll see. We're going to have to keep an eye on that, because it seems like there's some terrifying things and potential for terror by that. So New York is a huge city, and I'm sure you're going to see this more and more in big cities, that they're going to start relying on this. And it is nice. It is a warm, fuzzy feeling when you see a unsolved mystery solved. But at what cost if you're taking it away from normal people? We'll see. It's one of those things. I love to give you things to think about. Terrifying, isn't it? So, speaking of terrifying, Microsoft, their privacy policy, we talked about this a few weeks ago. They said they actually admit to having contractors listen to Cortana and Skype recordings. And there's no way to opt out for now. Ha! Thanks, Microsoft. You suck. So Microsoft's updated privacy policy says that, yep, we are doing that. We're having humans listen to your recordings, Cortana and other speech services. And the company has not yet allowed the customers to opt out. So this is very similar to other problems with Google Assistant, as well as Apple, that they all have humans that are allowed access to snippets of recorded conversations. And it's a privacy issue. And they do it to Skype. So you think of what you call grandma on Skype, and someone's probably listening every so often. Not that it's that interesting, probably, but it is, it's private conversations. Why are they listening? And who's to say how much they're listening? You know people. If you're bored with your job, you're probably sitting there listening to like whatever they're talking about. It's kind of terrible. So they go on to say that humans listen to speech recorded by users, and to build and train and improve the accuracy of our automated methods of processing, including AI, we manually review some of the predictions and inferences produced by the automated methods against the underlying data from which predictions and inferences are made. For example, Microsoft says, we manually review short snippets of a small sampling of voice data when we have taken steps to de-identify or to improve our speech services, such as recognition and translation. So, they said previously that Cortana will record your voice when it thinks you're accessing it or dictating speech, but it now says that the recordings may be subject to transcription of audio recordings by Microsoft employees and vendors, subject to local laws and restrictions. So Microsoft provides a list of all recordings it makes using your voice. And it says on its privacy dashboard, it's worth reviewing. This author contains random notes, questions of Cortana, snippets of voices of the author's kids playing on their family Xbox, chatting randomly to friends and each other. There's certainly no need for Microsoft to be recording the latter, especially children. So Microsoft does provide some privacy options. In Windows 10 privacy settings, you can turn off your PC's mic's access entirely, which is smart. Or you can place app-by-app limits on its ability to listen in. You can turn off, say, hey, Cortana, function entirely, turn it off. If you don't, Windows is always listening for the hey, Cortana trigger. And I turned it off on mine, so I didn't feel too worried about saying it. The privacy dashboard also allows you to clear the activity. So if you use Microsoft or, you know, Windows, Windows 10, whatever, go in and look at your privacy settings. Really look. See what you have turned on. You might want to be turning things off, right? So Microsoft isn't allowing you to block your voice samples from being reviewed by third parties, which is kind of sucky. Whether they're, you know, it doesn't matter who they are. It means you can totally never be sure that your conversations are totally private because you can't opt out. So they say on their on your privacy dashboard, there's a photo of their chief executive with the caption, "Your data, powering your experiences, controlled by you." You're not really controlling it if they don't let you opt out, kids. So that's not cool. They say easy to use tools and clear choices, and how Microsoft will be transparent about data collection and use so you can make informed decisions. Unfortunately, Microsoft appears to have made one privacy decision without giving its customers the power to opt out, letting contractors review your private recordings without identifying which recordings or allowing customers the ability to prevent it from happening. So be aware, they're abusing it, and they act like they're not. Microsoft. So if you use any of those software or you have it, just be aware it's listening. Big Brother is always listening. Okay. So this I'm going to go over briefly because I'm kind of running a little long. In Wired magazine, they talked about the fight over Section 230 and the internet as we know it. This is, we talked a little about 8chan having their hateful manifesto to the mass shooting a few weeks ago. And there's been a lot of legislation and talk about protecting Americans and protecting them from online censorship and tech companies policing speech too much and not enough. And there is lots of terrifying things going on. You should just know that anytime there's censorship options, they always seem to go overboard or they ignore it. Usually something, everyone freaks out and then it goes away. So I'm hoping it's the go away thing, but there's an Orwellian thing going on where in 1996, there's a Communications Decency Act, and there's a section of it that they're really focusing right now called Section 230. Remember that number. So Section 230, as it's commonly known, provides interactive computer services. That means like anything from your web host to websites, to social media companies, it gives them broad immunity from civil cases over the content that users publish on their platforms. So this gives them kind of a free speech clause that's like, it's not them, it's the people who are publishing on it, so they're not liable for it. So it's a good thing. It protects them. However, companies can still be held liable under federal criminal law and for intellectual property violations. So there's always a little, yeah, but. So among other things, this protection allowed social media companies to flourish without worrying about each and every post bringing some potential ruinous lawsuit, you know, like slander, libel, etc. But it's also come under increasing scrutiny with some critics arguing that tech firms need more accountability. Because we need to be protected from ourselves, obviously. So something tech companies have really gotten wrong, and it says they've proceeded for years basically treating Section 230 like it's a right that's enshrined in the Constitution. And this person, Jeff Kossoff, who wrote a book about Section 230 called 26 Words That Created the Internet. And there's a backlash to the arrogance that they say, which I still kind of believe in it. I think that, yes, there's some crazy stuff that's gone out there. But I'm kind of an anarchist in the idea that I think that have free ideas and people can deal with it themselves. Why do we need to have outside forces controlling it? You know. But then again, I also don't want some of these really horrible groups to have so much power. So, I mean, yeah, there's two things going on in my head that I can see both sides, but I really just don't want censorship. So the backlash is bigger or more consequential than in Washington, D.C. That's where they are really focusing in Congress. Both parties have singled Section 230 out for attack, both Democrats and Republicans. However, libertarians probably go, let's leave it alone. So Democrats saying it allows tech companies to get away with not moderating content enough because we got to protect the children. While some Republicans say it enables them to moderate too much. Yeah, there's not like, I feel like this is Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? Like, it's like, let's just get just right. How about just right? So the hyperpartisan divide on this, Section 230, yeah, we can agree on facial recognition software, but we can't agree on how we censor the internet. Great. But the shortcomings, they say, have precluded any meaningful progress and reform. You know, and I'm okay with that. They can both argue as long as nothing really happens to it, because that means we continue to have kind of free sharing of ideas. That's the nature of the internet, and I really hope we can keep it that way. They publicly criticize the inclusion of Section 230 like provision in a trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. They say that there's a liability shield, it's subject of much debate. I think there should continue to be. I think, is Section 230 safe, they say. The recent mass shootings debate make people go crazy, and they say the world has changed, according to Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri. The internet has changed, and I think we need to keep pace with change. The dominant monopoly-sized platforms that exist today didn't exist then. The business model that they employ today wasn't employed then. So they basically feel like we need to be protected. And they also yet say they don't want to censor conservative voices. So this is the problem. It's they don't want to have their opinion censored, but they kind of like other people's opinion censored. And that's just both sides. So we really just don't need censorship, okay, kids? And this is, there's an introducing a bill in June that in the Senate that would require the FTC to certify that companies like Facebook, Twitter, and Google do not moderate information provided by any other information content providers in a politically biased manner. I think that's fair, but how do you do it? They probably do AI, and then we know how well that works. So the constitutional questions it raises, along with the lack of support from Democrats, make it unlikely to succeed. So it creates kind of government information police. God, we are so living in 1984, aren't we? It just blows my mind. I look at this and it just makes my head spin. So they don't want Washington running their life. They get cell calls from the president. They'll get Gates, who's vocal critic of Section 230, says that he's discussed the issue with Trump officials, including that what we can do in the absence of legislation. So while Gates won't divulge the details of these private talks, he supports reining in tech companies. There is no First Amendment right for online platforms to have a unique shield from liability that is not enjoyed by newspapers, magazines, or television stations. Yeah, it's about the same thing, don't you think? Their websites have comment sections for users, and, you know, people can say controversial things and it can be protected. I think that should keep going on. It's noted there's scant evidence that social media companies are systematically suppressing conservative content because of users' political views. Let's keep it that way. People believe it. And I've seen there have been groups that have been shut down, and people, they say they're being shut down, and I haven't seen it yet, but if you have a what they consider a controversial viewpoint. So if they start really shutting down big groups, then I will say there is definitely a problem. I've only seen it happen with a couple groups so far, but you kind of wonder why them and why not someone else. And I've known people who get banned, it seems like, every other week. So I just don't really understand how you target what they consider hate speech. And when you see what they're banned for, it doesn't seem like hate speech. So, I don't know. I've never been banned. Isn't that interesting? We'll see. Now I probably will be. But I just think that as long as you play nice with everybody, and every once in a while you can disagree, you can have arguments. Why is this a thing? Why do we need to change this Section 230? I don't quite understand it. So it's very misunderstood. It goes about neutrality. And no one wants to be censored. But we also, you know, they're worried about dangerous individuals on the internet. So there is not a good fix for this. I think they need to leave it alone. Because I kind of want my free and wild internet, the Wild West. And, you know, commercial sites, they can control it how they want to. I think you should leave it up to the commercial, like, you know, yeah, Facebook sucks sometimes. And they take your privacy away. But you know what? You're doing it for free and they're providing a service. So if they want to ban everybody, they can ban everybody. It would be stupid. But you know what? Something else will rise up in its place. And maybe it's time for that. Maybe we need a new Facebook. Who knows? I just think that we need to be worried about it. And what's next? So for years, the very business models of platforms like Facebook and YouTube have come under fire for prioritizing whatever grabs the user's attention. So whatever's popular, it gets that. Section 230 has enabled those business models by shielding companies from responsibility for the user's behavior at its most extreme. So they used the provision to rule that Facebook couldn't be sued for providing a platform for terrorists, throwing out a lawsuit from the families of American citizens killed in the Hamas attacks. So in terms of solutions, Section 230 still might not be the right lever to pull. I think there's definitely a problem with hate speech. And there's all sorts of absolutely vile content online. Yeah, you know where to look. There's really horrible crap. The question is, how do changes to Section 230 deal with it? It's still going to exist. It's just going to move. And it'll be not in the one spot where it was, but you'll find it somewhere else. And then it'll be somewhere else after that. So in 22 years, there's only been one real update to Section 230. And it was the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act and Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. Removed Section 230 immunity for services that promote or facilitate prostitution. So it's a controversial amendment that led to broad self-censorship by many sites. And some sex workers say the fallout has made their lives more dangerous, not less. So, you know, I get why people, they want to be protected from seeing terrible things and they want to help people. But sometimes, even with our best intentions, we can hurt people. So I just feel like, leave it alone. Leave people alone. I know it may make you uncomfortable and you may see things that you don't like, but that's the world. That is the world. So we don't want to lose our First Amendment rights. And we don't want this to turn into that either. So it's been a nice thing so far, but I feel like we're right on the edge of that possibly changing too. So there are, Section 230 allows internet companies to make decisions confidently about fearing their liability. So you take that away, what is that going to do to our internet companies, to our social media companies? It will be a whole different world. And some people think that's a good thing. I myself believe that we need to just leave it alone. They're already doing their own kind of self-policing and you see it, but you know, free speech is where we're at. We're America. Free speech, baby. Okay. So I'm going to take just a little teeny break and When I come back, I'm going to talk real briefly about AcroCats, which is so awesome. You guys are going to love it. So I'll see you just in a second.
Solutions to Delusions. How do you do this? Well, join me every Friday night on the Delusion Solution Radio Show from 6 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time and 9 to 12 midnight Eastern Time right here on the Freedomizer Network, where we will be discussing and discerning the times by making sense of current events and bringing to light much-needed topics. Our calling number is 347-324-3704 to listen in. Watching with your ears and listen with your eyes. I'm your host, Tara Dawn, and I'll see you there. It has never been more clear that we, the people, must unite to preserve our freedom. All over the country, we are seeing similar fights against the systematic attempt to remove our medical choice and medical freedoms. So I welcome you to listen in to the Tell You Like It Is show on freedomizerradio.com. It's all about informed consent, being properly informed, and then making those decisions for your family and how you see fit. So join me, your host, Talia, live on Wednesdays and Thursdays every week on freedomizerradio.com from 10:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific.
Okay, welcome back to Liberty Librarian. So this weekend, I went to a really weird show, but I had a great time. It's called the AcroCats with the Rock Cats. And what AcroCats is it's a group, it's a nonprofit group, actually, that travels around the country. And they have like a whole bunch of rescue cats that this group trains. And they do tricks, it's nothing very dangerous, but the purpose of it is to raise awareness for feline adoption, that any cat can be trained. They do clicker training, if you've ever seen that. They have a little clicker and they give food, and the cats, when they hear the click, they do their trick, and then they get a yummy treat. And what I really like about this is that it's very humane. The founder is Samantha Martin. And I swear, I have a friend who says that, I don't know if it's her or one of the ladies at works is from out in North Carolina, Asheville. And I think they have groups around the country that they go around the country, show the cats, and they rescue cats and they help train them. But a lot of times they help them, these cats get adopted too. And it's really very cool. And in 2009 is when this started. And there's a team of cats, they're all former rescues and strays. And 4 years after this, Samantha Martin started the group, she got inspired to take an active role helping felines in need. So she was hoping to adopt a kitten she could train as a new member of the AcroCats. So her search led her to a crowded high kill shelter in Chicago. So, and they told that Martin had several kittens desperately needing foster homes, and that whichever ones weren't housed immediately would likely end up on that night's euthanasia list. How horrible, isn't it? And this woman took all 12 because she couldn't leave them. She couldn't let them just die that night. And it was, she said it was a life-changing moment. So fostering a shelter pet it means taking in the animal until it finds a permanent adoptive home. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of love. And some people, you know, I don't know. Like I always think about that is I probably end up keeping all of them forever and I'd be a true cat lady. But kittens are very highly adoptable, which is sort of weird why she had 12 that she had to take. But animal shelters are not well equipped to care for orphan kittens younger than 8 weeks old. They need bottle feeding and overnight care. So animals find foster homes less stressful than a shelter environment. I mean, both of my cats are rescue kitties. And when our first cat, Rory, he was a kitten. And, you know, he seemed to go to it really well. He was with his brothers, and we could only adopt one. So he came home with us and was a terror for a little while. And then he was very lonely, so we adopted our girl kitty, Zoe, later. And Zoe, she was an older cat, and she was not liking being in the shelter. She was older and didn't like it. She was a little scared of all of it. Very, still to this day, very scared of dogs. And she's, you can tell that just being in a shelter can sort of traumatize cats. And Rory was too little to remember it, I think, but Zoe was there long enough that she still to this day has issues, doesn't want to be held or grabbed. Just, you know, it kind of changes them over time. And yet, I love both of my cats very much. They're very sweet. And I think every day that I help them, they became a part of my family. And I really hope that if you're ever thinking about getting a pet, to at least consider rescue cat, rescue dogs. It really can change their lives. But anyway, back to AcroCats. This woman, Samantha Martin, she adopted these cats. And she didn't end up making any of those kittens part of her permanent cast, as she calls it. But she did help them find good homes. And those first dozen kittens started a lasting legacy for Martin and her AcroCats. She goes around the country helping cats get adopted. And she has human assistants and 17 cats, 16 performers, plus Captain Patch, which we got to see. Captain Patch is a one-eyed, non-performing feline who belongs to one of the assistants. And she just kind of hangs out, and everybody gets to visit, and very chill kitty. My friend Kara got to, I think, pet him a little bit, too. Very sweet kitty. And they reside in a deluxe three-level space inside a specially outfitted cat bus, which I will post pictures of the cat bus from our weekend adventure, and there's a cat car that was with them too. I'll post that on the Facebook if you want to see what it looks like. It's kind of neat. So the foster kittens never have problems adapting to life on the tour bus, Martin said. Since they're kittens, they're much more adaptable to new places and experiences. So kittens do okay. Older cats, not so good. So over the years, Martin and human AcroCats team members have fostered an estimated 209 kittens. Can you believe it? So most of them have found new homes, although a few especially promising ones have wound up sticking around to become performers. And they're very cute, guys. They're very well taken care of. What she does, and she said this in her show, is that she makes their treats. So they're actually, you know, not like junk food treats that you get at the grocery store. She actually... These are homemade treats from real meat because, you know, cats are obligate carnivores, right? So she proves also, because people seem to think cats don't ever listen. They kind of don't listen, but they do. They can be trained. All cats can be trained. There's different levels of how much they can be trained, and depending on how young they are and that. But I know I worked on training my cat Rory. He does a couple tricks. I do sit with him. I actually have also trained him with hand gestures. So he does sit still. But when he was a kitten, I was trying to potty train him. And it was going really well. And he was like hovering, and he's going over the water bowl. And he fell in one too many times. And, you know, you try to prevent it. I had one of those special seats. So you just make it a little smaller each time, a little smaller. And he was almost the end. And he had decided that after that, he'd rather go poop in a corner than ever deal with it again. So I feel like I probably should have tried a little bit longer. But, you know, sometimes cats got a cat. And there was no way Zoe was going to do it. But I still feel like if you get kittens, it's a perfect time to start clicker training. Look it up. It's really amazing. And if nothing else, you should try to train them to come to you, like either with a clicker or with a whistle, something. So if there's an emergency, like let's say there's a tornado or a fire or something where you need them to come to you right away so you can escape, it works. So if nothing else, think about training your pets, dogs and cats, to be able to come to you and have a system, have a way. So if you need to get out of the house in a hurry, that you have a carrier that's easily accessible. I have one that I have right by the door. So in case I need to grab them and go, I can stick them in there and we can get out of the house. So just things to think about. They're part of your family. So think about their safety and in case of emergencies, what you do. So anyway, the AcroCats, they can be trained and it helps behavioral problems. A lot of times cats get bored. And so if they're bored, you know, you leave them at home all day and you come home, you don't give them attention, you don't play, they get destructive behavior and it can cause aggression and health problems. Cats need to use their brains, just like people, just like anything. Some cats need more interaction than others. So training can help and also helps you bond with your pets. And one thing to know, like dogs, you can say bad dog and they listen because the pack is so important. But cats, negative punishment does not work with cats. Yelling at your cat when they poop on the floor does not work. Positive reinforcement is the only thing that really works with cats. So you get the desired behavior, give them a reward. And then the clicker kind of, they associate with the treats. So sometimes you can just use the clicker and then they do it anyway, which is nice. But then you give them a treat. And what was interesting to me is that, like, as many treats as I saw happening, the cats were, they're all healthy looking. They weren't fat. They weren't skinny. They were, you know, just right. Beautiful cats. So your cats may never be ready for prime time. But Samantha Martin said, teaching your pets some basic tricks keeps them mentally stimulated, strengthens your bond, and starting with short sessions of about 10 minutes a day. Don't be doing like all day training and expect them to do well. They're just like toddlers that way. So you don't overdo it. And even the professional troop at off times, she said the cats are her pets. Explained they roam around the house like normal house cats when they're not on tour. Are they allowed to just be cats? And she says they're always just cats. So at the show, you know, we were kind of amazed because they played music. They, you know, some of them ran up and like pulled down ropes. And they, I mean, it was nothing dangerous. It was just neat tricks. And every so often a cat would run into the audience just because they're freaking cats. And that's what they do. And it was amazing. And I hope if you ever get a chance, they have a website called circuscats.com. And I will post, it's very cute. It's cute. They go around and really it's raising awareness for, pet adoption, cat adoption, and really just learning how to train your cats. Their next town that they're going to is Greenfield, Indiana. So if you're there, in a couple days, 22 through the 25th, they're going to be there. And, they have a, on their page, you can donate to the Rock Cats Rescue. And I'll give you guys the link on the Facebook page for Liberty Librarian. It has, you can donate. And every time they come to a town, you can volunteer to help. On their page, they want a bus driver to help out. So if you love being around cats all the time, you can run away and join the cat circus. Do it. I just think it's so cool. And so if you get a chance, take a look at the website. You'll see a little bit more. There's some videos out on YouTube. They have a fan club. It's just really neat. So AcroCats, guys, it's fun. And my husband, while he loves cats, he was very amazed. They also have one chicken called Cluck Norris. So hilarious. And, you know, you can go up and get to visit with all the kitties and they're very nice and kid friendly show. It's good for the whole family. So I welcome it. I had a lot of fun. So please go check out AcroCats. And if you get a chance, you know, donate to your local humane society, any no kill shelters and adopt a rescue cat or dog, you know, any rescue pet that you can. Makes the world a better place and makes you a better person because, you know, give a little love to a cute little creature. So that's about all I got for today. I can't even believe I'm almost out of time. I always think I don't have enough to say, and I guess I do. But I hope you guys have a great week. I start going back to work at the library tomorrow, so back to school, rah-rah, and all that. But then next week, classes start, so back to the normal. But I assure you, next week, I will be there for you again. So have a wonderful week, guys. Have fun. Do good things. Enjoy the summer while it's still there. And I will talk to you next week. Bye, guys.
Tune in every Monday with your host, Heather Biederman, for the Liberty Librarian. Liberty Librarian, your home for intellectual freedom news and commentary. Every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern, all intellectual freedom fighters are always welcome at our home on Freedomizer Radio. Join us.